It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Shannon Bream.
I'm Tom Shalhoub.
I'm Maria Bartiromo, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, January 4th, 2023. I'm Lisa Brady. DNA leads to a suspect in the murder of 4 college students in Idaho. But what about a motive and a murder weapon?
If the DNA holds up however they got it and whatever they did, I would argue that it matters less because you have this very strong scientific evidence.
I'm Dave Anthony. North Korea's leader is vowing to overwhelmingly beef up his military after a record year of missile test launches.
By 2027, they may have 200 nuclear weapons, and they've shown a new emphasis on producing a new generation of smaller tactical warheads, potentially for battlefield use.
And I'm Tammy Bruce. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Nearly 7 weeks after 4 University of Idaho students were stabbed to death in an off-campus home, stunning the college community and the nation, a suspect, 28-year-old Brian Koberger, was arrested on Friday in Pennsylvania, where he was raised and his parents still live. State police there had been contacted by the FBI to help with surveillance, and Area 3 Commander Major Christopher Paris says the arrest was made in collaboration with Idaho state troopers.
It was through this collaboration and the charges pending in Idaho that those troopers were able to obtain search warrants and a fugitive from justice warrant that was prepared here in Monroe County.
Neighbors are describing Koberger as quiet and appearing shy. He grew up mainly in a rural area north of Allentown before his family moved to Albrightsville near India Mountain Lake.
Never saw anything suspicious. I guess that's part of the reason they hide out here is because there's a lot of land, a lot of seclusiveness.
More recent neighbors say they rarely saw Koberger, who was a graduate student at Washington State University, working on a PhD in the criminal justice program and living on the Pullman campus, only about 10 miles from the killings. Koberger waived his right to an extradition hearing in Pennsylvania yesterday, being sent back to Idaho to face charges including first-degree murder. Investigators haven't confirmed specifics, but say DNA evidence helped lead to his arrest, and they recovered a white Hyundai Elantra, the same kind of car that had been spotted near the crime scene in November.
Because this became such a forensic, intense investigation, forensic focused, including digital forensics, that stuff takes time.
Paul Morrow is a former New York City Police Department inspector.
The parsing out of the DNA from the victim's DNA to the potential perpetrators to find the foreign DNA, isolate it, then get it processed, then start trying to figure out how to match it, that takes a lot of time. So does digital, because the digital forensics, and what I mean by that is tracking things like cell phone pings, etc., those things take legal process, and they very often take a couple of rounds of legal process. So these things all take time. They're not instantaneous. People have to write search warrants and subpoenas and, keep the prosecutors busy. All of that takes a decent amount of time. And in this case, it does look like that the forensics writ large are what led them to the accused. We have to remember that he's still the accused, innocent until proven guilty. But it looks like, according to the reporting, that that's what happened.
Yeah, a lot of questions do remain about the case. But in terms of the DNA evidence, it seems like genealogy may be a big part of it. What was your first thought when you heard that? I mean, it's not the first case where that has led to a breakthrough or potential breakthrough recently, but it doesn't seem like something that's done routinely at this point.
No, it's not. It's actually very much an emerging field, and there's actually been a couple of missteps. There was a famous case a couple of years ago where somebody was accused of a rape based on genealogical evidence, and it turned out to be incorrect. It was a false match. And that person was ultimately exonerated. So it's certainly not a perfect science. And, law tends to work about 10 years behind science and society in general, because it takes a while to get, laws passed, et cetera. And this stuff is no exception. So we are still a little bit in the emerging era of this. We had early indications that there had been defensive wounds, et cetera. There was going to be some transferal in such a brutal crime. And so DNA was obviously one of the things that, you know, that came immediately to mind. I held out no hope that there would be a hit, or very little hope that there would be a hit in the CODIS database. My early supposition was that the best you would get would be perhaps a relative hit, and then you'd have to try to reverse engineer it. And sometimes those things end up being blind alleys.
Elaborate on that for me, if you would, for anyone who's not familiar with CODIS or with this reverse.
Okay, so CODIS is the governmental database of DNA, and what resides in there are perpetrators who've been arrested for felonies and who have been swabbed for DNA, and then it goes into the database, just like fingerprints. But it's not been around that long. Not everybody who is arrested gets that DNA swab. And as a result, it's not very populated as compared to, let's say, the fingerprint database. The other thing, too, is that people get fingerprinted for all sorts of other reasons. And so getting a CODIS hit is a lot more of a shot in the dark than, let's say, a fingerprint hit would be, which is something that we're all more familiar with. The genealogical database, however, is populated by the private genealogical databases, and there's a number of companies that operate in this space. Those are populated by people who want to find out things like, what is my ancestry? And so I was skeptical that that was going to have a whole lot to do here, not because I didn't think that it would work, because, as I said, there have been instances where it has worked, but because the private companies recognize that if the public perceives they are part of the law enforcement apparatus, people are going to be a lot less likely to send in their swabs. But another way around that is to do apparently what is being reported they did here, which is that they didn't go with a search warrant and push the sample through the genealogical database of the private company. They posed as customers and just sent it in as if they were a customer to see what hit they got back. So now it comes back, reportedly, to Brian Kohlberger's father. And so now they have a name. And so now all they have to do is say, okay, well, do we have a Kohlberger that resides in and around the Moscow area? And obviously we know that they did. Your next check would be, what does he drive? Because they'd already had been sitting on this data point of the white Elantra, and lo and behold, he has a white Elantra. Okay, so play that out. They now have this DNA hit in a genealogical database. It comes back to this guy Kohlberger, but the company seems to be indicating on their website that this is not at the evidentiary standard. So now what does law enforcement do? And by the way, this is all speculation. I don't know that's what they did, but this is me reading the tea leaves of what's leaked out. Now what you'd be left to do is something called paralleling, which is you'd have to say, okay, we're not going to fully rely for our probable cause to make the arrest on what we got back from this database. For us, that's just a clue at this point. It's a pointer. We got to build our probable cause another way.
And that would be obviously better than them having to rely on the genealogy, which, as you say, sometimes can be unreliable. This all sounds, though, like an opening for the defense team, which has already said, you know, he looks forward to being exonerated, and these seem like threads that they could pull.
So, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're going to find out a lot more when he appears in court. So just so people know procedurally what's going on, essentially what's going to happen is he's going to appear in court with his defense lawyer that he's got either hired or that they appoint for him, public defender out in Idaho. And he will be apprised officially of the charges against him. And then he will be asked to enter a plea. Apparently, he's going to enter a plea of not guilty. But what also is going to happen when he appears in court is that the complaint that they used, and that's what it's called out there, the official document is the charging document now is a complaint, is going to become public under Idaho law. That's the probable cause document. That's going to have the evidence that the police and the prosecutors judged would be enough to get them probable cause to arrest this guy. And that's going to become public. And so a lot more of what's on the table here is going to be apparent as soon as he appears in that hearing.
Assuming that, you know, some kind of DNA evidence is a big part of that, how much now does determining a motive or finding the weapon matter? Does it matter less now, or does it matter more to get a conviction?
I would argue if the DNA holds up, however they got it and whatever they did, I would argue that it matters less because you have this very strong scientific evidence. And in this era of the CSI effect, if you can go in and show a jury that, look, this is what was under Zanna's fingernails, it's this guy's DNA, and there's absolutely no reason she should have his DNA under her fingernails, and he's never been in that house before, and by the way, it's also on Maddie's hands, you know, it's going to be very, very tough for him to talk his way out of that. Now, that said, obviously, you know, the more evidence you have, the better, and the narrative of why he did this is always going to be important. One of the things that I think many people don't realize, certainly non-prosecutors don't realize, is that a prosecution is built around a narrative. And so if you have a motive that you can demonstrate, it becomes very integral to the narrative. It becomes comprehensible to a jury as to why this person did what he did. So that's why motive is important. Obviously, you want all of these things, but doesn't mean that you have to have them. And if they never find the knife, and if he'll never give up why he did what he did, and it actually ends up in trial, I think that, you know, if they have the DNA evidence and if they have a few of these other data points, I'm sure that they're going hard at the interior of that Elantra, you know, it still could definitely be enough.
This suspect has been a criminology student. Are you at all concerned that this case could lead to some sort of backlash on this field of study or even an attempt to, you know, limit or screen students in those programs somehow?
You know, not really. I think this is such an anomaly. I know that now, you know, people are looking backwards and they're saying, oh, the BTK killer was also, you know, a criminology student. The Golden State killer was a former cop. So, you know, I think these things are sort of flash in the pan fascinations. I think it'll that aspect of it, I think, will come and go. It is an interesting aspect of it that he, you know, was so committed to the field of criminology that he was getting his PhD. I actually find a subtlety in there, Lisa, that I think nobody seems to be talking about very much. But this guy is 28 years old, and I have not seen any reporting that he held gainful employment. And now he is getting his PhD while working as a teacher's assistant. Again, not something that pays very much. So my question is, how has he been keeping heart and soul together? How has he been paying for all of this school? And what has he been doing with his life? Because even as a PhD candidate, you know, he's not going to graduate with the PhD, arguably, until he's leaning on 30. What has he done in his spare time? What are his interests? He doesn't seem to have any friends. He apparently has never had any sustained relationships. So That intrigues me and, to be honest, creeps me out a little bit. And I suspect that someplace in Pennsylvania, there are folks in my former line of business who are saying to themselves, let's start looking backwards at cases that have remained unsolved, homicides or missings, because, you know, you have to ask yourself the question, did he start his career, assuming this is him again, you know, all this is predicated on the idea that the accused is who did this crime. Did he start his career with this stuff with a quadruple homicide? That's a pretty big jump. And so I'm interested in some of the backstory here that I don't think has come out yet.
Chilling. Former NYPD Inspector Paul Morrow, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
This is Tammy Bruce with your Fox News commentary coming up.
There's been a lot of talk about the growing threat of nuclear war after Russia invaded Ukraine last February, and the fighting still rages on. It prompted President Biden to say at the United Nations General Assembly,
no matter what else is happening in the world, the United States is ready to pursue critical arms control measures. A nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought.
But Russia is hardly the only threat. There's Iran and also North Korea. Its leader, Kim Jong-un, warned on New Year's Day he's ordered his government to overwhelmingly beef up the military, including more nuclear weapons. Last year, North Korea implemented a new law authorizing the use of those bombs for preemptive strikes, as it launched dozens of missile tests, by far a record.
It's very dangerous and has been for some time.
Bruce Klingner is Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation, a former CIA Deputy Division Chief for Korea.
By 2027, they may have 200 nuclear weapons, and they've shown a new emphasis on producing a new generation of smaller tactical warheads, potentially for battlefield use. And then in the last several years, they've revealed over a dozen new missile systems of all ranges that are all more capable than the predecessors. And they have several ICBMs that they've demonstrated could target the entire continental United States. So the nuclear and missile forces are very worrisome. They also have a large conventional force, and they're also a very strong cyber attack capability. Their refusal to abide by UN Security Council resolutions or enter into any form of dialogue with Washington and its allies, it's all very, very worrisome.
They've had sanctions on them for a long time over this nuclear program, but they don't seem to care. So they just keep going on and on and on, and all the ballistic launches, they violate these UN sanctions and resolutions. So what can anyone really do?
Well, there's not a lot of optimism left in the room. You know, we should keep the door open for diplomacy, as successive administrations have tried to do. North Korea has been refusing to have any kind of meetings since about November 2019 or October 2019. So we need to keep trying on that. And also, we can step up our game on sanctions. There's a lot of misperceptions of sanctions. But one problem has been the U.S., through successive administrations, has not even fully enforced U.S. laws. We could be going after Chinese banks and businesses to a far greater degree. And that can have an impact on North Korea's programs, not necessarily get them to give them up, but at least it could impede them. And it could alter the behavior of these Chinese banks and businesses. Just one example is, in the past, the U.S. imposed $8 to $9 billion in fines on British and French banks for money laundering for Iran. So far, we've imposed $0 in fines on Chinese banks for money laundering for North Korea. And that's in the U.S. financial system.
Now, Bruce mentioned 2019. That's the year after the famous U.S.-North Korea summit. President Trump hailed it as a breakthrough, meeting face-to-face with leader Kim Jong-un just months after warning at the United Nations General Assembly, if the U.S. has to defend our allies like South Korea,
we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
A second Trump-Kim summit fizzled. The president walked away as the nuclear disarmament and sanctions talks fell apart. That was in February 2019, and lower-level negotiations also went nowhere after.
That last meeting in October 2019 during the Trump administration, the U.S. officials said North Korea wouldn't even define what they wanted when they would say, what do you mean by denuclearization? What do you mean by a security guarantee? What do you mean by an end of war declaration? North Korea just refused to identify it. So it's really hard to have, you know, any kind of diplomatic progress if not only do they refuse to talk, but even when they do, they won't define what they want. And diplomacy is each side giving a list of what they want, and you try to negotiate the linkages. But so, you know, as they're refusing to talk, we just need to keep enforcing our own laws and maintaining and increasing our deterrence capability. And we saw that during really the second half of last year when the U.S. and South Korea and Japan resumed large-scale combined military exercises after a four-year hiatus. So that was a way of repairing some of the degradation of our capabilities. And then North Korea showed that they didn't like that. And so then that was one reason why there was a lot of missile launches in the second half of the year, because they were trying to intimidate us to cancel the exercises that we had just resumed.
Now, there's talk that the U.S. and South Korea may be discussing even allowing South Korea to be a participant in U.S. military operations, in the sense that, I mean, we help them with a nuclear umbrella. South Korea does not have a nuclear weapon. So
Are we going to let South Korea have a bigger role at the table dealing with the nukes that we have?
There's very little discussion in Washington, but during my recent trips to Seoul, it's quite a big topic of discussion. There's a lot of advocacy for South Korea going nuclear, very high public opinion polls in favor. I think they don't understand the downsides if they were to go down that path. There's, I think, some confusion. President Yoon of South Korea said that, you know, the U.S. and South Korea were going to have these joint nuclear exercises. President Biden said, no, we aren't. So I think, as has been in the case through other South Korean presidents, they may be saying things that aren't quite true as a way of kind of gaining public approval. So I don't think it's a good idea to put TAC nukes back in the peninsula. I don't think it's a good idea for South Korea to go nuclear. Nuclear sharing is also a bit troublesome, but I think we should be more forthcoming in nuclear planning or shared nuclear planning, more transparency with South Korea. And there's been a resurrected extended deterrence working group between the U.S. and South Korea that started last year. And I think that's a good avenue to try to address South Korean concerns without them going down some paths that I don't think would be good.
North Korea has not had an actual nuclear test since 2017. Is one coming?
We think so. You know, that said, both Washington and Seoul have said all preparations are complete and a test is imminent within days. And they've been saying that since March. Now, if all preparations are complete, what that means is a device is in the tunnel. The tunnel has been filled with rubble to prevent venting of radioactive gases. And nuclear experts will say you don't want to leave a nuclear device in a tunnel for any length of time. So subsequent satellite imagery showed that the tunnel was not packed. So I think they must have had some indication that there was an intention to do a test. Whether they had picked a date and then delayed it or just hadn't picked a date, what we're expecting is not a massive test like they did back in 2017, which was 10 times the size of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki atomic weapons.
Wow.
But a small weapon, which would show that they have completed development of this new battlefield used tactical nuclear weapons, which, though smaller, are very worrisome because it shows yet another new threat to South Korea as well as U.S. forces and citizens.
So what is the difference between, you know, the big nuke that we think of that blows up a whole city or a small battlefield version? What's the difference?
Well, it could be directed at, you know, a tank division or allied forces that are moving north after repelling a North Korean invasion. So we're not sure, but they are on short-range missiles. So they could be used, as North Korea has declared they would be, for going after South Korean ports where U.S. forces would be coming in, South Korean airfields that military operations would be occurring at, or U.S. forces flowing in, hardened military command headquarters, as well as advancing troops. So small, but still very, very deadly.
Does North Korea really want war? You've been studying this, as you said, for all these years. Do you think they really want war?
I don't think they want war. And, you know, some people still think Kim, you know, is this crazy little guy and he's just going to start a war. He's not crazy. I mean, he's obviously a brutal dictator, but neither he nor his father, his grandfather are crazy. The concern is more that there could be either an inadvertent escalation or a mischaracterization of what's happening. So the other concern is an escalation where, you know, a little clash along the DMZ gets bigger and bigger and bigger and eventually turns into a large military clash or even a nuclear exchange. You know, that said, North Korea does have a war plan to unite the peninsula within 7 days, which means they would have to go nuclear early as well as chemical and biological weapons. So they have the capability. They have a declared intention. Not that we think they're coming through the wire tonight, but we always have to be very concerned about that growing capability.
Meanwhile, their people still suffer, right? I mean, they had COVID last year. Even Kim Jong-un admitted there was a food crisis last year. Conditions in that country are still not good, right? I mean, it's still dire.
Oh, it's awful. Political repression. The people are prevented from having access to the outside world, though information sort of sneaks in. But people can be executed simply for watching South Korean TV shows that are smuggled in on thumb drives. You know, and often three generations of a family are punished for the crimes of one. And also the economic conditions are awful, given the decades of bad socialist economic planning, but also exacerbated by the basically cutting their country off from the world for 2 years, and then also some, you know, natural disasters from weather. And then the sanctions have also restricted their economic activity. But, you know, by cutting themselves off even from China, which is accounting for 90% of their trade, you know, their conditions are very bad. And we've seen indications that the crop harvest this year could also be bad.
Do they make money on cyber attacks? Is that where they get all their funding? How do they get the money for all this?
Well, that has been a new source of funding. And what we've done is as we've followed their cyber activity, it's moved from sort of cyber attacks, espionage, you know, denial of services, you know, ransomware, et cetera. The last several years, they've turned first to cyber bank robbery and then to cryptocurrency. So several years ago, they hit the Central Bank of Bangladesh. They got away with $81 million. In a bank robbery. They would have gotten $1 billion if someone hadn't noticed some typos in the bank transfers, including through the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Wow.
And they're probably making about $1 billion a year in cyber crime, though one wonders what impact the crash of cryptocurrency has had on them. They probably had a lot of money that they hadn't converted to real currency yet.
Bruce Klingner, Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation, former Deputy Division Chief for the CIA for Korea. Great to talk to you. Thank you again.
Well, thanks again for having me.
And in other news,
I'm Gianna Gelosi. GoFundMe has released its annual donations report for 2022, listing many statistics, including the most generous states and cities of the year. Topping the list as the most generous states per capita, Vermont, Delaware, Maine, New Hampshire, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Georgia, South Carolina, Montana, and Virginia. Digging even deeper, the top five most generous cities of 2022 were Marietta, Georgia, Spring, Texas, Silver Spring, Maryland, Sarasota, and Bradenton, Florida. Filling out the top 10, Olympia, Washington, Alpharetta, Georgia, Miami and Fort Myers in Florida, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. The site reports one donation every second, with 28 million people giving a combined $25 billion in 2022 to nonprofits and charities. The news of the year also impacting what people donated towards. In 2022, there was a 110% increase in donations towards baby formula, a 60% increase in fundraisers for gasoline, 10% increase in fundraisers for groceries. $2.3 million was raised for Eagle and Girl Scouts projects. $9 million raised for various places of worship. $150,000 raised for veterans. $50 million for dogs and cats. $108 million to rebuild houses after natural disasters. And $250 million raised for Ukrainian relief. The most generous day of the year was May 26th, following the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas. For the Fox News Rundown, I'm Gianna Gelosi.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Tammy Bruce.
What's on your mind?
Normally, if you design a guide for your entity and it's based on your supposed values and it's meant to improve people's lives, you would make sure the world knows about it and be proud to share it with everyone. Stanford University, however, had another idea. When everyone found out that their little Orwellian Elimination of Harmful Language initiative had developed a guide of forbidden words, Stanford panicked and locked the censorious project behind a firewall and began to gaslight everyone about what its intentions were. Fortunately, the Stanford Review, the university's independent newspaper, is filling us all in with the latest shenanigans of what used to be a premier university having slouched toward woke in the most predictable of ways. In a story titled Big Brother is Watching You, Stanford's New Harmful Language Guide, we are given a peek at the insanity driving the woke. with an agenda of supposedly eliminating racist, violent, and biased words from its IT systems and websites. Instead, they provide the rank absurdity driving today's woke mob. A sampling of the words and phrases considered too toxic and damaging to be used include walk-in, as it's insensitive to the disabled, so drop-in is to be used instead. White paper is racist and will be replaced with position paper. Karen will be swapped with demanding or entitled white person. The Daily Mail tells us it also says it will swap the term blind review for anonymous review, while tone deaf should be swapped for unenlightened and handicap parking changed to accessible parking. It also states in its gender-based section that pronouns should be used instead of preferred pronouns, as the latter implies that gender identity is a choice. The section on institutionalized racism states that black mark and black sheep are not used because of negative connotations to the color black. I'm not kidding you. And now even the woke term trigger warning is now too triggering and will be replaced with content warning. Making the most news is the elimination of the word American to be replaced with U.S. citizen. Why? American, quote, often refers to people from the United States only, thereby insinuating that the U.S. is the most important country in the Americas, which is actually made up of 42 countries. You just can't make up this sort of madness. The mocking and outrage was so swift and merciless, Stanford's chief information officer issued a classic backpedaling statement saying they missed the mark and that the guide does not represent university policy. This latest iteration of the vandalism of language started decades ago with the idiocy of political correctness. It is now part of the bureaucratic agenda throughout our establishment. The tiny tyrants among us also know that if it is too dangerous and forbidden to use certain words and phrases, we will eventually stop thinking about things which require those words to convey our own assessment of society and culture and politics. We will retreat as only silence is safe, and that is exactly the point. If the next generation is going to have any hope of living decent and free lives and being able to function in society, this circus of the absurd must be condemned and stopped. Stanford can issue mea culpas all they want, but nothing will change. Americans everywhere mocking and denouncing the fools who implemented this is an important step, but Stanford alumni must get involved, speak up, and say enough is enough.
This is Tammy Bruce.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown, and now stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at briankilmeadeshow.com.